come back to our seats quietly. That'd be great. If you stand, it's quiet. All right, we'll get started as soon as we get a seat. Well, thank you so much for enduring. Hopefully, no one has been scared away. I think everyone's actually ready to go a little further. Depending on how this goes, there's a lot of ground to cover here as well, and I appreciate your attentiveness. I'd like to see, if at all possible, if we can have some Q&A. I don't know how that's going to work exactly. If there's a microphone, will there be a microphone passed around? Should you have a question, please feel free to think of your question now while we speak. But I want to get into the gender issue now, not in terms of transgender, not that. It's specifically women and men, and the issue of equality, women's equality with men. This is also a tough thing. You know, I was writing this book on the tail end of the original surge of the Me Too movement. The Me Too movement is continuing on inside of it. It's interesting because the Me Too movement really exposed quite a bit of the power structures within secular institutions. And of course, this has bled over into the church as well, where women were being treated as basically objects or whatever it might be. And so this brought to fore quite a bit of issues about women's equality in this country, even though, you know, on the books, there's every reason to believe that women have equal rights as men, the matter of treatment. Which goes to show you something, by the way. The fact that the Me Too movement, that we need to have a Me Too movement in the first place, the fact that we need to have a Title IX in the first place to give women equal access to sports and all this stuff, goes to show you something. It shows you two things. The first thing is, if we were inherently good, we were inherently fair people, we had no sinful condition, as most religious systems would teach you, then we wouldn't need these laws. We would just be fair. Why do we need all these laws? And there's a lot of them on the books. Second thing is this, though. The fact that there are this many laws and we still have a need for a Me Too movement tells you something. Law does not change hearts. Hearts can change laws, and they can work together. And I'm not saying we should do one or the other. I think that we should do both at the same time. But this is an important part of the Christian experience, is that when you look at Christian history, you know, Mark Twain was once quoted as saying, history does not repeat, but it does rhyme. And I think Twain's right. Whether he said that or not, I don't know, but it sounds very Twainish. I think he's right about that. When you look at the history of Christendom, with all of its check marks, and all of its pock marks, and all of its darkened past, there's quite a bit of bright lights. Women's equality is one of them. And I think it starts in the very book of the Bible, actually, and bleeds over in every aspect of the biblical narrative. This is quite a challenge. And a little bit tough of a challenge, too, because there are, again, we'll go through them, some really tough chapters and some tough sections of the Bible that seem to suggest that women have a second-class rating from men. But is that true? Is it actually true? So I'm going to dive right into those things. I've already set the stage in terms of the moral question, because like racism, sexism is a moral question, and that question itself doesn't have any basis unless God exists. The question is it the God of the Bible? I mean, you have atheists like Richard Dawkins who call God a vindictive bully, a misogynistic, sexist, malevolent, you know, genocidal, male-favoring bully. And is that the case? So let's look at the Old Testament as an example to see if that's the case here. Because that's where a lot of challenge lies, in the Old Testament. Now, I'm not going to go into every specific verse of the Bible that might pose some level of challenge. I've done quite a bit of that in the book, so if you'd like to get a copy of the book to go through some of the details, please feel free. I told someone earlier today, by the way, that the proceeds to this book, they go to Feed Hungry Children, they just happen to be mine. So let's look at the Bible. What you would expect to see is women who are never the heroes of the story, or who are oftentimes the villains of the story, or the ones who lead men astray. And that happens, because that's reality. It also happens that men lead women astray, because that's reality too. you see equal footing where people are equally the heroes and equally the bad guys in these stories, because the Bible seems like a book that's telling you how it actually was. It doesn't try to change things in some fantastical, legendary way that makes certain people look like heroes and other people look like villains. People get treated pretty, people seem to get the short end of the stick, or at least are the propagators of these people. Regardless if they're Jews or not, or if they're males or females or not, it is accurate.
But you look at the Old Testament,
and these are important things. Look at the way women actually are described, even in the first five books of Moses. When you look at Miriam, Moses' sister, and Yocheved, Moses' mother, women of tremendous faith, who actually saved men. It was the women who lied, or lied in a way to keep the men alive, who basically said all these people were either girls, these newborn babies were girls, because the Egyptians were looking to kill the firstborn males of all the Hebrews.
Or they put a baby in a basket and sent them on the way, having faith that God would actually save this baby. And then Miriam and Yocheved eventually are involved in Moses' life in the palace of the Pharaoh. So you see women exercising some tremendous faith, even in the beginning there. Then you see some other things that are important. You see entire books of the Bible, Esther, Ruth, these books that are named after women. They're named after women. In fact, let's take a look at the book of Esther. This is remarkable, by the way. In the corpus of scripture, there's this interesting book of the Bible called Esther, where God has not been mentioned even once. It makes its way into the holy revelation of the Bible for some reason. Even though it seems to be a historical record, it's saying, look, there was this time of exile when the king of Persia took over, the Jews were in exile in Persia, and the king had them in exile with this guy named Haman, who hated Jews, and he hatched a plot to exterminate all the Jews and all this stuff. And Esther is this hero, along with Mordecai. Esther is a hero, a central figure. In fact, the book is not called Mordecai. The book is called Esther. So Esther is this Jewish girl who rises to the place of the queen in Persia. Now that might sound like a whole lot of important influence, but it really kind of isn't. How do I know that? Read the beginning of the book of Esther. By the way, these are the little nuggets, these little signals that I love in the Bible. The first woman mentioned in the book of Esther is not a Jew. It's Vashti. Vashti is the queen of Persia. She's the wife of the king. And the king has his gala, his ball, his banquet over here with the men, probably some women too, probably women who are not his wife, in that gala, and then the women have their own thing going over here, and Vashti's holding a party, essentially, of women apart from the king. Now, why is this important? Because not even the queen could be in the presence of the king unless the king summoned her first. And if you came in unsummoned to the king, what had to happen was, if the king saw you approaching and he kept his scepter at his side, it meant that you are not welcome, and that was a sentence of death. He had to raise his scepter to accept you if you did not come in uninvited. Sorry, if you came in uninvited. So Vashti, this is an important detail we often miss. Vashti is a woman described in the Bible as incredibly beautiful. Incredibly beautiful. Now, the king, Xerxes, and his boys are probably good and loaded. And he gets it in his mind that he's going to parade his trophy wife around to show the boys just how beautiful his wife is compared to theirs. And so he summons Vashti. Now, what does Vashti do? She says, no. I will not be paraded around by a piece of meat. And she pays for it. She gets basically banished. But I want you to notice something. Just notice this. Vashti is heroic. As a woman and a non-Jew, race and gender, same story. The first hero in that story is Vashti. And it's a woman who's brave and will not be objectified. The Bible is eternally contemporary because right now, people look at this machine. Okay? This thing. You call on a phone, no one makes calls on this anymore. This machine right here has more computing power than the first computers that sent the rockets to the moon. My phone, my one phone, has more computing power than NASA had. And you know what we do with these things? We call them names now. We say, hey, Superior, or Alexa, or whatever you call your thing. We humanize these things. We humanize these machines. And what do we do with these machines? We look at things we don't like to look at. We objectify women and men as well to serve some base need of our own. How ironic is it that we humanize machines we use to objectify humans? And why? Thousands of years ago, refused. Because the Bible is signaling something about the way in which we treat people as if they're objects, especially women, eternally and temporarily. We're wrestling with that in our so-called enlightenment age today. And this book was telling us thousands of years ago, don't do it. Don't do it. She's a hero. But then the book of Esther actually has this wonderful narrative here, because Esther doesn't know what to do exactly. They do hatch a cool, very ironic plan where Haman, the guy who hates the Jews, ends up being ensnared in his own plan. But in order for this plan to actually come to fruition, Mordecai basically encourages Esther and says, Esther, you need to go into the king and do this thing so this plan can come to fruition so we can be free. Our people are going to be slaughtered unless you do this. And she says, I'm going to die if I go in there. And he says, well, you might have been born such a time as this. God is not mentioned in this book, but his providence is evident in this book, because Esther was called to this specific task at this specific time, and Mordecai is recognizing the importance of Esther's life as a possible person who saves her people from destruction. And so what does Esther do? Picture this just a moment, if you could. Here's this woman who is now elevated to the status of the queen as a Jew. The king doesn't know she's a Jew. And she's going to go into the presence of the king uninvited. She's got to go uninvited, risking her life. And she's thinking, if he raises his scepter, I'm saved. And maybe my people can be saved too. But if I perish, I perish. I'm going to risk it. I'm going to risk my life for the sake of the people. And so she's standing in front of that most likely monumental door with her forehead pressed against that thing, thinking, here I go, here I go, here I go. And her breath starts to quicken, and her pace starts to quicken, and her pulse starts to quicken. And she's thinking, am I really going to do this? Am I really going to do this? And she does it. She walks into that room, and there's that king. And with every step she's taking towards that king, she's wondering, is he going to raise that scepter or not? And then he does. I want you to notice something. Esther, a woman, is given the role of savior for her people. She is a type and shadow of the to come. And a woman, scandalous in those days, by the way, a woman is given that place. That's one. Ruth, the Moabite, not a Jew. So faithful is Ruth. So wonderful is her sacrifice and her steadfastness in the face of all that she's going on and the redemption that needs to happen. That she becomes the grandmother of David, and she is, as you mentioned, in the genealogy of Jesus. And by the way, I don't know if you know this, but back in the day, when you did a genealogy of some great man, you didn't include women. And the Bible is not this way to do it, including non-Jewish women. And the race and the gender issues are all over the place. It's almost like you can't even turn a page of the Bible without being addressed, at least implicitly. Huldah is a woman who's a prophet in the Bible. And of course, there's Deborah, who's appointed by God to be a judge over the people of Israel. She's given authority. You see this time and time and time again. In fact, let me tell you, I was doing a radio show with a woman who was a Muslim. She became an atheist, and we were talking about why she became an atheist, but why I, as a Muslim, became a Christian. And we didn't talk about it there, but we talked about some of her issues, and some of her issues about Islam was the way it treated women, the way it made women second-class citizens. And so the host asked her off the air, have you considered Christianity and how it deals with women? And she said, well, I've looked into it a little bit, but it seems to me like it doesn't fare any better than Islam. So I said, oh, well, let me give you some examples of some women who are rose to prominence. And you don't see this in Islam, but you see this in the Christian faith, where women have prominence. And I listed off like six women who have this tremendous authority and prominence in Jewish life and in the first century church. And she said, where is that in the Bible? You can hear it in her voice. She's like, that's in there? Folks, most people don't know this. I'm going to say sadly, most Christians don't know this. But it's there, it's so rich, it's in there. We ought to know this stuff so well because the culture is in desperate need of these truths, and we are in desperate need to tell them. Let me give you a couple of examples of something, of some important stories here, or some passages. Let me look at the biblical passages first, and then I'll go to the stories. So let's look at some mythical passages in the Old Testament. So for example, in the Old Testament, it seems to be, this is a common criticism, by the way. I remember I was speaking at a university, I think it was my very first non-church event after I became a Christian. I was speaking at a university local to where I live, and I was speaking on why I became a Christian. I was doing a dialogue with the guy on why he became a Muslim from a Christian background. And so the Christian group that was there decided to, hey, why don't we go through the school, I'll give you a tour of the student building, and the student museum, we're great, let's see it. So we come across it, we've got to show you this. And it was a display that was put up by the Secular Student Alliance, the atheist group on campus. And this is back when Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, and Christopher Hitchens, the four horsemen of the new atheism, were selling books by the millions. And in the display, it was a display case, they had the Bible and certain passages of the Bible all laid out. And they had words false written over top of them. And it was passages like, if a woman gets raped, she has to marry her rapist. Women are unclean for twice as long as men for certain issues and all that stuff. They had all this stuff up there. Then they had, in the other case, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett's books, and they had the words in bold letters, true, on those books. Because they pointed out all these false and these horrible things about the Bible and women. I remember thinking to myself, wow, that's a whole lot of talking out of context out there. But it sends a powerful message. The rhetorical force of that is pretty strong. I mean, if you were to tell somebody that the Bible actually requires a woman to marry her rapist, like, what? Are you kidding me? That condones rape and makes a woman the slave of her rapist. That's awful. But does it do that? So you read the passages, and I don't have a reference here. It's in the book, by the way. The references, you look at the actual context here, and if you look at the historical context, a woman, because of the pretty bad circumstances at the time, women just weren't as upwardly financially mobile as men back then. And the Bible is a realistic book. It actually deals with people in their sin and tries to regulate the sin so it curbs the awful that people have to go through when they're subjected to these horrible things, like the misogyny of your day, where they couldn't make the same amount of money, they didn't have the level of leadership, or they hadn't been married in order to survive it back then. And so the Bible accommodates, it doesn't condone the evil action, but it regulates even what it doesn't condone. How do I know this? A good friend of mine, Amy Hall, pointed this out, is that you notice this passage in the New Testament, when Jesus is talking about divorce, how marriage is so sacrosanct, and men and women ought not divorce, what God has brought together, let not man tear asunder. Then, of course, the Pharisees say, and why was it that Moses gave a writ of divorce then? Why is it in the law if we can't divorce? Why is it prescribed in the law? And what Jesus says is, because of the hardness of your hearts, but in the beginning, it was not intended to be so. It was not meant to be this way. In other words, God regulates the things he does not condone. But he knows that our hearts are hard, and we're going to be awful to each other. So, because of our sinful condition, he actually regulates the awful out of existence and curbs it. So, in this situation, a woman gets raped. Now, in the ancient Near East, when you compared this law to the laws of the ancient Near East around the Israelites, women fared far worse than this. What would happen to women is that either they would be judged as the harlots who asked for it, and they would be either killed or imprisoned or fined in some way, because first of all, they couldn't even prove it. A woman's testimony meant literally nothing. So if she said, that guy raped me, and there were not witnesses, and how many times were the witnesses? Almost never. She was basically accused of falsely accusing somebody, and she could be killed for that. What's going on here is that a woman who is raped probably won't get married again after that, because if it gets around, men want, you know, unfortunately, what they wanted was making sure she's a virgin and all these other things to make sure that they have, you know, their own, you know, sort of ownership of this woman. So the Bible, what it does, it says that the woman doesn't have to run away. She's not required to get married to her. It's not required. But what is required to get married is required to marry her, which means that he has to take care of her financially for the rest of his life. And the Bible has no indication whatsoever that she's going to have to live with her. She can be in a different village. She can stay with her father and her brothers and be protected and provided for by them. But this man is basically given a life sentence you have to take care of her for the rest of his life if he's not stoned to death for doing it. So the context is completely different. It basically says women are in a tough spot, and because of that tough spot, this guy put her in an even tougher spot, and he will not be getting away with it. And this woman, who unfortunately will probably never see some of the benefits that otherwise, I think, free society would give, she will be taken care of. And it'll be this man's responsibility to do that. And given the fact that he's not allowed with a wife, he doesn't have to marry anybody else. So he can't mess around either. There's a whole lot more to it than this. Then you look at the New Testament, and you think to yourself, doesn't Paul seem to say in 1 Corinthians chapter 14 and in 1 Timothy chapter 2 that women can't speak in church? Not only can they not leave, they can't even talk. Go ahead and read those passages for yourself and see it. It seems to suggest that Paul's saying in 1 Corinthians 14, women can't speak. It says, as in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says, if there is anything they desire to learn, let them ask their husband at home, for it is shameful for women to speak in church. That sounds bad. That sounds pretty bad. In fact, so bad that Kathy Keller, Kim Keller's wife, points out that these are what are called the so-called texts of terror. A lot of women just bristle at this. 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 8 to 15 seems to suggest the same thing. But here's the interesting thing. When you read it in its context, Paul clearly is not saying that women in general in all churches should be silent. Let me unpack that for you. I think careful reading of the scriptures helps us with this. Now, you might have different theologies about women's leadership and all that stuff. I'm not here to solve that one even a little. Okay? Don't expect that. That's not happening today. What I'm here to talk about is whether or not this passage suggests women should be silent in some way because they're lesser than them. And I think the answer is no. And that's true if you're a complementarian or you're egalitarian. In fact, Kathy Keller herself, who was a complementarian, coming from a Presbyterian background, she says this passage does not require women to be silent, that they can't be ordained about that. So she believes that. But she says this passage does not treat women as unequal. And there's a couple of reasons why. The first thing to notice is this. That Paul cannot be saying in 1 Corinthians 14 that women ought to be silent in church, because just three chapters before that, in 1 Corinthians 11, Paul says women ought to prophesy and pray out loud in church. So he can't be condemning the very thing he just had done to know. That can't be what's going on here. In 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 28, Paul ranked the gift of prophecy as higher than the gift of teaching. So women can prophesy and pray, and that's higher than teaching, but they can't teach. He's not talking about whether or not women are equal in some way or lesser in some way. He's talking about an exigent circumstance at the time. And so what do we know about this? At the time that Paul wrote to the Corinthians, and he wrote to Timothy as well, what was going on was there was a lot of influx of women and men followers from both paganism and from Judaism, especially in Corinth. We get all kinds of, when you read 1 Corinthians, you're like, man, we got issues. You kind of fix and address all these issues. One of those issues was that some of the women from the pagan backgrounds were actually foisting onto other people, because they were foisted on them, some beliefs that were antithetical to the gospel. Like, childbearing is actually a form of slavery. Like, you should wear certain things and do certain things, and women can usurp the authority that men would normally have. And so these false teachings were creeping into the church. This is important for a moment here, too. The Corinthian church was a nascent church. It was a baby church. This is the first century. These are the first decades of the gospel movement. And what you need is not just people gathering. What you need is sound, biblically literate teaching. And the reality of the circumstance was that only people who were qualified, because women were not given educations back then, the only ones who were qualified to actually teach anything of any import to the church were men. Not because they were better, just because they were in a better position. And so what Paul is talking about is essentially there are people who are usurping the authority of men without the qualifications that actually would come with it. In a nascent church, you have to protect in its infancy. And so he's saying, this is a problem you have to deal with. Well, someone might say, well, wait a minute. 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33b says, as in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent. So you can't be talking about this one because it's one issue. Well, that's a possibility. But another way to look at it is this. First, the chapter and verse conventions we see in the Bible, you know, 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33b, didn't exist in the original manuscripts. We invented that in order to basically say, turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 33. But when you see the original manuscripts, there's actually no space between the words in it. The manuscripts are, to our thinking right now, are almost unreadable. To them, they can read them all the time. We invented spacing. We invented chapter and verse numbers so that it could be easily referenced. So those weren't there. So some reputable translations of the Bible, I'm not saying this is the way to translate it, but some of them translate that verse as in all the churches of the saints in 33b, as saying, instead of saying as in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in the churches, they actually take as in all the churches of the saints and attach it to the verse before that, which is 33a, so it reads like this. For God is not a God of confusion, but of peace, as in all the churches of the saints. And then he goes on to say, in this church, because of these circumstances, women should remain silent, because they're usurping the authority of men and women, and it's hurting you guys, and it's hurting them. We have to take care of this early church and deal with it. Now, how do I know that Paul didn't consider women to be second-class citizens? How do I know this? Because when you see what Paul does, and how he actually lists women by name repeatedly as those who were not only supporters of his ministry, but his co-laborers, his important co-laborers in the service of the gospel, he does this over and over and over again. Paul has this thing for mentioning names, and sometimes it's not a great thing if you mention by Paul in the letter. I don't know if you've noticed that, if you've read your Bible closely enough. Sometimes being named by Paul isn't so awesome. But a lot of times it's great. He mentions women like Lydia and Junia and Priscilla. I'm going to pause on the Priscilla one for a moment. Paul mentions Priscilla and Aquila. Aquila is her husband. Now, in first century Jewish thought, and in contemporary Greek thought back then, if you were going to list a husband and a wife, oftentimes you leave the wife out completely. So, listing her already is victory. But if you listed a husband and a wife in a public document to be read out loud to other people, what you did was you listed the man first because of his prominence and his importance. The woman was an afterthought at best. And what happens here is he says numerous times how much he likes Priscilla and Aquila. Priscilla is first. And that's no accident. This is not an accident. You see it all over Paul's writings. And of course, you see it in the life of Jesus over and over again. Let me give you a couple of examples of some stories that I think will highlight. Again, looking through the lens of these verses and saying, are they cloudy or can they become clear? If you look through the life of Jesus as your lens, you'll see it become quite clear. Here's a story of Mary and Martha. You know the story. It's preached commonly at churches, and the point usually at churches, and it's the right point, it's a good point, by the way, is that you ought to stop from all the busyness and actually enjoy who Jesus actually is. Don't be so bogged down in business of life and the sort of worldly priorities that you miss the spiritual truths of life. You know, stop and still Messiah also. So here's the story. Mary and Martha. You know the story. I'll repeat it anyway. So Mary and Martha, the sisters of Lazarus, they are hosting Jesus and the boys for dinner. And like good Middle Easterners, they want to have and make sure that they make sure that the hospitality is top flight, top notch. And so they're working to make sure that everything is in place for Jesus and the guys to come and have a good time. They love Jesus, they love his disciples, and they want to make sure to show them a good time at their house and show them all the food and all the whatever they need to show them, right? So Martha is busy doing all the work, and Mary sits at Jesus' feet. Now I want to pause for a moment. There's a thing, essentially, where you get a culture in it,
where you get so used to the bad conditions you're living in that you think it's actually right. It's like Stockholm Syndrome, kind of, but a cultural kind of version of it. But a woman did a study, I cited her book as well. A woman did a study a long time ago about women who are entering the workforce of traditionally male roles or traditionally male areas of the workforce. I think it was sales of some kind, dominated by men, an area dominated by men. And so what they found was you had a sales office where there were like 8 men and then 1 woman. And the woman had to endure the boys and boys jokes and the terrible behavior of these men. She had to endure that and endure that and endure that. And she got used to it as a survival mechanism. Okay, I have to keep this job. I have to live with this kind of stuff. And that's very much pre-Me Too. What they found interesting was if another woman joined the office, eventually that woman and the other woman would actually find solidarity together, but not at first. At first, the first woman would actually be like, oh my goodness, I'm so grateful someone else is taking this a little bit of pressure off of me. And they would, in fact, sometimes join the ritual of the woman as well. In other words, they were so used to this misogynistic horrible behavior that at times they found themselves, even unwittingly and unknowingly, being okay with it happening to somebody else. Until they sort of come to their senses about these things and wait a minute, this is wrong. Martha and Mary are told in the first century that their place is in the kitchen or with a loom, with spinning weave clothes, and no one else really. And no one else really. In fact, when you look at the rabbis who are contemporaneous with Jesus, they say things like, it is better to bury the law in the ground than it is to teach it to a woman. One rabbi who was scolding another rabbi for taking money, for teaching a woman the law. The guy said, well, shouldn't the law be taught? He says, not to the woman, and especially not for money. Women have no wisdom whatsoever. This is first century Judaism, even a little before that. This is what, now, I wouldn't say it's predominantly Judaism, but some of the religious leaders were acting this way. They'd say things like, it is more dangerous to walk in front of a hungry lion than it is to walk behind a woman. This is the milieu in which Jesus is operating, in which Mary and Martha live. So Mary and Martha are told to be told their whole lives, you are to be in the kitchen. The woman's place is in the kitchen. And then you see the story. Now think of that and think of the story now, is that Martha is doing what her culture tells her to do. She's in the kitchen. Nothing wrong with being in the kitchen unless it becomes a prison. So here she is at work for many things, and she is upset, she's angry, that Mary is left to do all the work. She's angry that she's at Jesus' feet. And by the way, that idea of being at someone's feet, a rabbi's feet, was not considered an insult. It was considered an honor to sit at a rabbi's feet for any man. And no one was allowed that. But here is Mary sitting at the rabbi of all rabbis' feet. And Martha is upset. So what does she say? She says, Jesus, don't you care that my sister Mary has to do all the work? Tell her to come and help me. First thing you'll notice is that Martha doesn't say, Jesus, come help me. This is not his place. It doesn't even occur to her to ask Jesus to help her. Tell my sister to come help me. But what does Jesus say back? Pay careful attention. He says, Martha, Martha, you are worried about many things, but only one thing is needful. Mary has chosen what is better. Free will. A woman to get an education of her own choosing, something to deny her for a whole life. And then Jesus says, and will not be taken from her, not even by you. You're offering the same education, Mary. I said, Martha, Mary has chosen it, I'm giving it to you too. In a world where women were not given these kinds of opportunities, Jesus says, I will not stand for it. He does this over and over again. I look at passages in the scriptures where Jesus is talked to by a woman and he helps her, he brings her into the story so that she becomes the teacher of the people around him. He is not so ego-driven that he has to be the only one saying cool things. He lets them say cool things too. Think of the Canaanite woman who comes to him and says, have mercy on me, my daughter is sick and all these things. And he says, you know, it's not right for the food meant for the dog, for the children to go to the dogs. He's not calling her a dog because she's a Canaanite. He's basically saying, all these people around you, this is a very Middle Eastern woman, by the way, I saw immediately as soon as I read it. All these people around you
call you a daughter because you're a Canaanite woman. And I want you to engage in banter back and forth. Middle Easterners love to do this. We love to banter back and forth and prove a point through banter. He invites her to be in the banter. And she says, yes, but even that, which was meant for the children, the scraps fall in the dogs to eat. And he says, great is your faith. To this Canaanite, not an Israelite woman, he basically tells everybody else, you expected me to be racist. And this woman's pointed out how racist all of you are. And she gets the blessing. There's way more to talk about with that, by the way. And maybe we can do it later. But it's important you see this over and over again, the way women are treated, not only as people who are deserving of dignity and respect, but as equals also deserving of dignity and respect. Jesus allowed a scandalous thing to happen. He allowed women to financially support his ministry. The Bible specifically says the women financially supported his ministry. That would be considered such an unmanly thing to do. And he does it because he gives them the dignity of saying, you can contribute more than just making clothes or taking care of stuff at home. We can all be in this together. What a thing to do. What a thing to do. In the gospel message, from the beginning to the end of the scriptures, you look at the way Elizabeth responds to the message from the angel that she will give birth even in her old age and in her barrenness. And she does not scoff. She does not do a thing like her husband. They're like, what? Say, okay, great. Her faith is rewarded so beautifully. Mary receives the prophecy of that she will bear the Son of God so eagerly. They're at the cradle. They're throughout his ministry, and they serve throughout his ministry. And they're there at the cross as well. And then they're there at the empty tomb. I want to pause for a moment there because this is really important, friends. The central miracle that makes Christianity worth believing, that makes the gospel any good news at all, is not that Jesus died on the cross for you and me, but that he died on the cross and then rose from the dead to prove that his death did something. Because if he died and stayed dead, who knows? Maybe he did something, maybe he didn't, I don't know. But if he rose from the dead, and it's a verifiable fact, then you can know that what he did meant something. It did something. It actually paid for your and my sins. So the central miracle of Christianity that sets it apart from every other system of religion in the world is the resurrection of Jesus. And who are the first witnesses to see the resurrected Lord? Women. Now, if you're going to make up that story, I'm going to tell you right now. The woman's testimony in the first century was worthless, or virtually worthless in the first century. It was an unfortunate fact of history. So if you were making up a story about the risen Jesus, and you wanted to say, I need some really credible witnesses to include in his story so that people will believe it. You say Peter, John, James, shoot, you'd even say disciples no one ever talks about. You'd say Nathaniel was there, Bartholomew was there. You'd say somebody other than women was there, because women aren't valid witnesses in the first century. But the Gospels specifically say the women were the ones who saw the risen Christ first. Why? Because that's how it actually happened. So this will make you a little bit too. The fact that women were the first witnesses of the chief miracle of the Bible does two things at the same time. It shows you the credibility of the Bible because it tells you a story in a way that's sort of embarrassing. That's how it actually happened. But it also does the second thing. It tells you how much God values women. So it responds to historical issues and it responds to social issues. It's like God wrote this book or something. And how does he reveal who he is? Because you know, Mary's there, not his mother, but the other Mary is there, and she doesn't recognize that it's Jesus in the garden of the tomb. How she knows him? She calls his name. Sorry, he calls her. He says, Mary, I see you. I know where you are. This culture means nothing to make you important. And I'm actually making your name a part of the record. So her name, not just some nameless woman happened to be there. Mary, your name will be written in my word for eternity. That's something. That is something. Simon Greenleaf, sorry, John Greenleaf, but the two Greenleafs. One's a lawyer, one's an abolitionist. John Greenleaf Whittier was an abolitionist.
And he wrote a poem about the birthright of womanhood.
Beautiful. And he says, "O the orphan wronged and stainless ill, behold thou art a woman still, and by that sacred name in dear, I bid thy better self appear. Still, through that foul disguise I see the rudimental purity that spite of change and loss makes good thy birthright claim for womanhood. And the inward loathing, deep, intense, ashamed of his half innocence, cast off the grave clothes of thy sin. Rise from the dust thou liest in, as Mary rose at Jesus' word, redeemed in the white before the Lord. Reclaim thy lost soul in his name. Rise up, cast off thy bonds of shame. Art weak, he strong. Art fearful, hear. The world's overcomer, be of cheer. What lip shall judge when he approves? Who dares to scorn the one he loves?" The world will tell, and have told women, there's a shame to this, there's a dirtiness to this, lie in the dust. And John Greenleaf Whittier says that no one can scorn or dare scorn the women that he loves. Let me wrap it up with this. "If Let Me Heart," a historian, a philosopher, who knows a fair bit of history himself, he pointed this out about the word, about the birth of equality. Goes all the way back to what I was saying in the beginning of our night together. Is that the birth of equality did not start with the Romans. In fact, there's a guy named Tom Holland, not the Spider-Man guy, the actual historian, who wrote a book called Dominion, where he set out to prove that everything good about Western society, all the equality issues, all the justice issues, all the sanitation, everything good about Western culture came from the Romans. And then he, in his research, realized Rome was a dark, ugly, horrible place. And the only thing that good, that good that came out of Rome is what Christianity put into Rome in the first place. This is a historian, a secular historian, who wrote this. And so, seeing that reality, David Let Me Heart actually points this out. He says, "It is simply the case that we distant children of pagans would not be able to believe in any of these things, like equality and free and equal rights and women's rights and these kind of things." He says, "We would not be able to believe in any of these things. They would never have occurred to us had our ancestors not once believed that God is love, that charity is the foundation of all virtues, that all of us are equal before the eyes of God, and that to fail to feed the hungry or care for the suffering is to sin against Christ, and that Christ laid down his life for the least of these." Hart is saying that these ideas we debate about, racism and sexism and all these things, our outrage would never have occurred to us had the Christian message not taught us that we are all equally made in God's image. And Christ says, "You're all also equally sinners, but you're all also equally offered salvation." Equality was not a Roman characteristic. The word person, by the way, comes from the Latin word persona, which means mask. It's an artificial thing. So in the Roman system, you were not considered a person by virtue of your birth. You had to earn personhood by virtue of your status or your service to the Roman Empire. The Christian message says, no, you are a valuable person made in God's image, and that's what gives you your value. Not the state, not other people, because you can just take it away. But God gives you that inalienable right, which makes that right inalienable in the first place because of everything. If you look at the Samaritan woman, we'll come back to this lovely woman. Being a Samaritan didn't define her. See, our social theories today, all the theories that we have today, there's some good in them, but there's some pretty serious shortcomings in them as well. And one of them is they make race and ethnicity and gender about everything. It's all defining. The gospel says they're important, but they're not ultimate. The Samaritan woman was not defined by being a Samaritan. She was not defined by being a woman. Because she was to worship in spirit and in truth. It was the spiritual, the intangible, that was really real about her. By crossing ethnic barriers, by crossing gender barriers, Jesus simultaneously valued her ethnicity and he valued her gender without making them the most important thing about her. think this is what the Bible actually teaches us. Ethnicity and our gender are divinely given expressions of who we are, but God's image is the divinely given definition of what we are. But until we can see that, we're never going to actually see each other as equal, because the only thing that makes us truly equal is that divine fingerprint all over each one of us in equal measure. The cross is the equalizer for all men and all women. And I invite you to think about that. Say, my goodness, what a man, what a savior, what a God. Thank you all.
His amazing case. If you can write us a check and help pay for this, it would be helpful. Abdu will be around for a few minutes to sign a book. Thank you for coming. You're only halfway through. Your sentence is only halfway done.